I ask. How? She digs in the pack she carries and pulls out a handful of leaves. I'm almost certain they're the ones my mother uses. Where'd you find those?
Just around. We all carry them when we work in the orchards. They left a lot of nests there, says Rue. There are a lot here, too.
That's right. You're District 11, agriculture, I say. Orchards, huh? That must be how you can fly around the trees like you've got wings. Rue smiles. I've landed on one of the few things she'll admit pride in.
Well, come on, then. Fix me up.
I plunk down by the fire and roll up my pant leg to reveal the sting on my knee. To my surprise, Rue places the handful of leaves into her mouth and begins to chew them. My mother would use other methods, but it's not like we have a lot of options. After a minute or so, Rue presses a gloppy green wad of chewed leaves and spit on my knee.
Oh!
The sound comes out of my mouth before I can stop it. It's as if the leaves are actually leeching the pain right out of the sting. Rue gives a giggle.
Lucky you had the sense to pull the stingers out, or you'd be a lot worse.
Do my neck, do my cheek, I almost beg. Rue stuffs another handful of leaves in her mouth, and soon I'm laughing because the relief is so sweet. I notice a long burn on Rue's forearm.
I've got something for that.
I set aside my weapons and anoint her arm with the burn medicine.
You have good sponsors, she says longingly.
Have you gotten anything yet? I ask. She shakes her head.
You will, though. Watch.
The closer we get to the end, the more people will realize how clever you are. I turn the meat over.
You weren't joking about wanting me for an ally?
She asks.
No, I meant it, I say.
I can almost hear Haymitch groaning as I team up with this wispy child. But I want her because she's a survivor, and I trust her. And why not admit it? She reminds me of Prim.
Okay,
she says, and holds out her hand. We shake.
It's a deal.
Of course, this kind of deal can only be temporary, but neither of us mentions that. Rue contributes a big handful of some sort of starchy root to the meal. Roasted over the fire, they have the sharp, sweet taste of a parsnip. She recognizes the bird, too. Some wild thing they call a grousling in her district. She says sometimes a flock will wander into the orchard, and they get a decent lunch that day. For a while, all conversation stops as we fill our stomachs. The grousling has delicious meat that's so fatty the grease drips down your face when you bite into it.
Oh, says Rue with a sigh, I've never had a whole leg to myself before.
I'll bet she hasn't. I'll bet meat hardly ever comes her way. Take the other, I say.
Really?
She asks. Take whatever you want. Now that I've got a bow and arrow, I can get more. Plus, I've got snares. I can show you how to set them, I say. Rue still looks uncertainly at the leg.
Oh, take it,
I say, putting the drumstick in her hands. It will only keep a few days anyway, and we've got the whole bird plus the rabbit. Once she's got hold of it, her appetite wins out, and she takes a huge mouthful.
I'd have thought in District 11 you'd have a bit more to eat than us, you know, since you grow the food, I say.
Rue's eyes widen.
Oh, no, we're not allowed to eat the crops.
They arrest you or something? I ask.
They whip you and make everyone else watch, says Rue. The mayor's very strict about it.
I can tell by her expression that it's not that uncommon an occurrence. A public whipping's a rare thing in District 12, although occasionally one occurs. Technically, Gail and I could be whipped on a daily basis for poaching in the woods. Well, technically, we could get a whole lot worse. Except all the officials buy our meat. Besides, our mayor, Madge's father, doesn't seem to have much taste for such events. Maybe being the least prestigious, poorest, most ridiculed district in the country has its advantages, such as being largely ignored by the capital as long as we produce our coal quotas.
Do you get all the coal you want?
Rue asks. No, I answer. Just what we buy and whatever we track in on our boots.
They feed us a bit extra during harvest so that people can keep going longer, says Rue.
Don't you have to be in school? I ask.
Not during harvest. Everyone works then, says Rue.
It's interesting hearing about her life. We have so little communication with anyone outside our district. In fact, I wonder if the game makers are blocking out our conversation, because even though the information seems harmless, they don't want people in different districts to know about one another. At Rue's suggestion, we lay out all our food to plan ahead. She's seen most of mine, but I add the last couple of crackers and beef strips to the pile. She's gathered quite a collection of roots, nuts, greens, and even some berries. I roll an unfamiliar berry in my fingers.
You sure this is safe? Oh, yes. We have them back home. I've been eating them for days, she says, popping a handful in her mouth.
I tentatively bite into one, and it's as good as our blackberries. Taking Rue on as an ally seems a better choice all the time. We divide up our food supplies, so in case we're separated, we'll both be set for a few days. Apart from the food, Rue has a small water skin, a homemade slingshot, and an extra pair of socks. She also has a sharp shard of rock she uses as a knife.
I know it's not much, she says as if embarrassed, but I had to get away from the cornucopia fast.
You did just right, I say. When I spread out my gear, she gasps a little when she sees the sunglasses.
How did you get those?
She asks. In my pack. They've been useless so far. They don't block the sun, and they make it harder to see, I say with a shrug.
These aren't for sun. They're for darkness, exclaims Rue. Sometimes, when we harvest through the night, they'll pass out a few pairs to those of us highest in the trees, where the torchlight doesn't reach. One time, this boy Martin, he tried to keep his pair, hid it in his pants. They killed him on the spot.
They killed a boy for taking these? I say.
Yes, and everyone knew he was no danger. Martin wasn't right in the head. I mean, he still acted like a 3-year-old. He just wanted the glasses to play with, says Rue.
Hearing this makes me feel like District 12 is some sort of safe haven. Of course, people keel over from starvation all the time, but I can't imagine the peacekeepers murdering a simple-minded child. There's a little girl, one of Greasy Say's grandkids, who wanders around the hob. She's not quite right, but she's treated as a sort of pet. People toss her scraps and things.
So what do these do? I ask Rue, taking the glasses. They let you see in complete darkness, says Rue. Try them tonight, when the sun goes down.
I give Rue some matches, and she makes sure I have plenty of leaves in case my stings flare up again. We extinguish our fire and head upstream until it's almost nightfall. Where do you sleep? I ask her. In the trees? She nods. In just your jacket? Rue holds up her extra pair of socks.
I have these for my hands.
I think of how cold the nights have been. You can share my sleeping bag if you want. We'll both easily fit. Her face lights up. I can tell this is more than she dared hope for. We pick a fork high in a tree and settle in for the night just as the anthem begins to play. There were no deaths today.
Rue, I only woke up today. How many nights did I miss?
The anthem should block out our words, but still I whisper. I even take the precaution of covering my lips with my hand. I don't want the audience to know what I'm planning to tell her about Peter. Taking a cue from me, she does the same.
2, she says. The girls from District 1 and 4 are dead. There's 10 of us left.
Something strange happened. At least, I think it did. It might have been the tracker-jacker venom making me imagine things, I say. You know the boy from my district, Peeta? I think he saved my life.
But he was with the careers. He's not with them now, she says. I've spied on their base camp by the lake. They made it back before they collapsed from the stingers. But he's not there. Maybe he did save you and had to run.
I don't answer. If, in fact, Peter did save me, I'm in his debt again. And this can't be paid back.
If he did, it was all probably just part of his act, you know, to make people think he's in love with me.
Oh,
says Rue thoughtfully.
I didn't think that was an act.
Course it is, I say. He worked it out with our mentor. The anthem ends, and the sky goes dark. Let's try out these glasses. I pull out the glasses and slip them on. Rue wasn't kidding. I can see everything, from the leaves on the trees to a skunk strolling through the bushes a good 50 feet away. I could kill it from here if I had a mind to. I could kill anyone.
I wonder who else got a pair of these, I say.
The careers have 2 pairs, but they've got everything down by the lake, Rue says. And they're so strong.
We're strong, too, I say, just in a different way.
You are. You can shoot, she says. What can I do?
You can feed yourself, can they? I ask.
They don't need to. They have all those supplies, Rue says.
Say they didn't. Say the supplies were gone. How long would they last? I say. I mean, it's the Hunger Games, right?
But Katniss, they're not hungry, says Rue.
No, they're not. That's the problem. I agree. And for the first time, I have a plan. A plan that isn't motivated by the need for flight and evasion. An offensive plan. I think we're going to have to fix that, Rue.
Chapter 16 Rue has decided to trust me wholeheartedly. I know this because as soon as the anthem finishes, she snuggles up against me and falls asleep. Nor do I have any misgivings about her, as I take no particular precautions. If she'd wanted me dead, all she would have had to do was disappear from that tree without pointing out the tracker-jacker nest. Needling me, at the very back of my mind, is the obvious. Both of us can't win these games, but since the odds are still against either of us surviving, I manage to ignore the thought. Besides, I'm distracted by my latest idea about the careers and their supplies. Somehow, Rue and I must find a way to destroy their food. I'm pretty sure feeding themselves will be a tremendous struggle. Traditionally, the career tribute strategy is to get hold of all the food early on and work from there. The years when they have not protected it well, 1 year a pack of hideous reptiles destroyed it, another a game-maker's flood washed it away. Those are usually the years that tributes from other districts have won. That the careers have been better fed growing up is actually to their disadvantage, because they don't know how to be hungry. Not the way Rue and I do. But I'm too exhausted to begin any detailed plan tonight. My wounds recovering, my mind still a bit foggy from the venom, and the warmth of Rue at my side, her head cradled on my shoulder, has given me a sense of security. I realize, for the first time, how very lonely I've been in the arena, how comforting the presence of another human being can be. I give in to my drowsiness, resolving that tomorrow the tables will turn. Tomorrow it's the careers who will have to watch their backs. The boom of the cannon jolts me awake. The skies streaked with light, the birds already chattering. Rue perches in a branch across from me, her hands cupping something. We wait, listening for more shots, but there aren't any.
Who do you think that was?
I can't help thinking of Peter.
I don't know. It could have been any of the others, says Rue. I guess we'll know tonight.
Who's left again? I ask.
The boy from District 1, both tributes from 2, the boy from 3, Thresh, and me. And you and Peter, says Rue. That's 8. Wait, and the boy from 10, the one with the bad leg, he makes 9.
There's someone else, but neither of us can remember who it is.
I wonder how the last one died, says Rue.
No telling, but it's good for us. A death should hold the crowd for a bit.
Maybe we'll have time to do something before the game makers decide things have been moving too slowly, I say.
What's in your hands?
Breakfast, says Rue.
She holds them out, revealing two big eggs.
What kind are those? I ask.
Not sure. There's a marshy area over that way. Some kind of water bird, she says.
It'd be nice to cook them, but neither of us wants to risk a fire. My guess is the tribute who died today was a victim of the careers, which means they've recovered enough to be back in the games. We each suck out the insides of an egg, eat a rabbit leg, and some berries. It's a good breakfast anywhere.
Ready to do it? I say, pulling on my pack.
Do what?
Says Rue, but by the way she bounces up, you can tell she's up for whatever I propose. Today we take out the career's food, I say.
Really? How?
You can see the glint of excitement in her eyes. In this way, she's exactly the opposite of Prim, for whom adventures are an ordeal.
No idea. Come on, we'll figure out a plan while we hunt, I say.
We don't get much hunting done, though, because I'm too busy getting every scrap of information I can out of Rue about the career's base. She's only been in to spy on them briefly, but she's observant. They have set up their camp beside the lake. Their supply stash is about 30 yards away. During the day, they've been leaving another tribute, the boy from District 3, to watch over the supplies.
The boy from District 3? I ask. He's working with them?
Yes. He stays at the camp full time. He got stung, too, when they drew the Tracker Jackers in by the lake, says Rue. I guess they agreed to let him live if he acted as their guard. But he's not very big.
What weapons does he have? I ask.
Not much that I could see. A spear. He might be able to hold a few of us off with that, but Thresh could kill him easily, says Rue.
And the food's just out in the open? I say.
She nods. Something's not quite right about that whole setup.
I know, but I couldn't tell what exactly, says Rue. Katniss, even if you could get to the food, how would you get rid of it?
Burn it. Dump it in the lake. Soak it in fuel.
I poke Rue in the belly just like I would Prim.
Eat it?
She giggles.
Don't worry. I'll think of something.
Destroying things is much easier than making them. For a while, we dig roots, we gather berries and greens, we devise a strategy in hushed voices. And I come to know Rue, the oldest of six kids, fiercely protective of her siblings, who gives her rations to the younger ones, who forages in the meadows in a district where the peacekeepers are far less obliging than ours. Rue, who when you ask her what she loves most in the world, replies, of all things, music.
Music, I say.
In our world, I rank music somewhere between hair ribbons and rainbows in terms of usefulness. At least a rainbow gives you a tip about the weather.
You have a lot of time for that?
We sing at home, at work, too. That's why I love your pin,
she says, pointing to the mockingjay that I've again forgotten about.
You have mockingjays? I ask.
Oh, yes. I have a few that are my special friends. We can sing back and forth for hours. They carry messages for me, she says.
What do you mean? I say.
I'm usually up highest, so I'm the first to see the flag that signals quitting time. There's a special little song I do, says Rue.
She opens her mouth and sings a little four-note run in a sweet, clear voice.
And the mockingjays spread it around the orchard. That's how everyone knows to knock off, she continues. They can be dangerous, though, if you get too near their nests. But you can't blame them for that.
I unclasp the pin and hold it out to her. Here, you take it. It has more meaning for you than me.
Oh, no,
says Rue, closing my fingers back over the pin.
I like to see it on you. That's how I decided I could trust you. Besides,
I have this.
She pulls a necklace woven out of some kind of grass from her shirt. On it hangs a roughly carved wooden star. Or maybe it's a flower.
It's a good luck charm.
Well, it's worked so far, I say, pinning the mockingjay back on my shirt. Maybe you should just stick with that. By lunch, we have a plan. By early afternoon, we're poised to carry it out. I help Rue collect and place the wood for the first two campfires. The third she'll have time for on her own. We decide to meet afterward at the site where we ate our first meal together. The stream should help guide me back to it. Before I leave, I make sure Rue's well stocked with food and matches. I even insist she take my sleeping bag in case it's not possible to rendezvous by nightfall.
What about you? Won't you be cold? She asks.
Not if I pick up another bag down by the lake, I say. You know, stealing isn't illegal here, I say with a grin. At the last minute, Rue decides to teach me her mockingjay signal, the one she gives to indicate the day's work is done.
It might not work, but if you hear the mockingjays singing it, you'll know I'm okay, only I can't get back right away.
Are there many mockingjays here? I ask.
Haven't you seen them? They've got nests everywhere, she says.
I have to admit I haven't noticed. Okay, then, if all goes according to plan, I'll see you for dinner, I say. Unexpectedly, Rue throws her arms around me. I only hesitate a moment before I hug her back.
You be careful, she says to me.
You too, I say. I turn and head back to the stream, feeling somehow worried. About Rue being killed. About Rue not being killed and the two of us being left for last. About leaving Rue alone. About leaving Prim alone back home. No, Prim has my mother and Gail and a baker who has promised she won't go hungry. Rue has only me. Once I reach the stream, I have only to follow it downhill to the place I initially picked it up after the Tracker Jacker attack. I have to be cautious as I move along the water, though, because I find my thoughts preoccupied with unanswered questions, most of which concern Peeta. The cannon that fired early this morning, did that signify his death? If so, how did he die? At the hand of a career? Or was that in revenge for letting me live? I struggle again to remember that moment over Glimmer's body when he burst through the trees. But just the fact that he was sparkling leads me to doubt everything that happened. I must have been moving very slowly yesterday because I reached the shallow stretch where I took my bath in just a few hours. I stopped to replenish my water and add a layer of mud to my backpack. It seems bent on reverting to orange no matter how many times I cover it. My proximity to the Careers' camp sharpens my senses, and the closer I get to them, the more guarded I am, pausing frequently to listen for unnatural sounds, an arrow already fitted into the string of my bow. I don't see any other tributes, but I do notice some of the things Rue has mentioned, patches of the sweet berries, a bush with the leaves that healed my stings, clusters of tracker-jacker nests in the vicinity of the tree I was trapped in, and here and there the black-and-white flash of a mockingjay wing in the branches high over my head. When I reach the tree with the abandoned nest at the foot, I pause a moment to gather my courage. Rue has given specific instructions on how to reach the best spying place near the lake from this point. Remember, I tell myself, you're the hunter now, not them. I get a firmer grasp on my bow and go on. I make it to the copse Rue has told me about, and again have to admire her cleverness. It's right at the edge of the wood, but the bushy foliage is so thick down low I can easily observe the career camp without being spotted. Between us lies the flat expanse where the games began. There are four tributes, the boy from District 1, Cato, and the girl from District 2, and a scrawny, ashen-skinned boy who must be from District 3. He made almost no impression on me at all during our time in the capital. I can remember almost nothing about him, not his costume, not his training score, not his interview. Even now, as he sits there fiddling with some kind of plastic box, he's easily ignored in the presence of his large and domineering companions. But he must be of some value, or they wouldn't have bothered to let him live. Still, seeing him only adds to my sense of unease over why the careers would possibly leave him as a guard, why they have allowed him to live at all. All four tributes seem to still be recovering from the Tracker Jacker attack. Even from here, I can see the large, swollen lumps on their bodies. They must not have had the sense to remove the stingers, or if they did, not known about the leaves that healed them. Apparently, whatever medicines they found in the cornucopia have been ineffective. The cornucopia sits in its original position, but its insides have been picked clean. Most of the supplies, held in crates, burlap sacks, and plastic bins, are piled neatly in a pyramid in what seems a questionable distance from the camp. Others are sprinkled around the perimeter of the pyramid, almost mimicking the layout of supplies around the cornucopia at the onset of the games. A canopy of netting that, aside from discouraging birds, seems to be useless, shelters the pyramid itself. The whole setup is completely perplexing. The distance, the netting, and the presence of the boy from District 3. One thing's for sure, destroying those supplies is not going to be as simple as it looks. Some other factor is at play here, and I'd better stay put until I figure out what it is. My guess is the pyramid is booby-trapped in some manner. I think of concealed pits, descending nets, a thread that, when broken, sends a poisonous dart into your heart. Really, the possibilities are endless. While I'm mulling over my options, I hear Cato shout out. He's pointing up to the woods, far beyond me, and without turning, I know that Rue must have set the first campfire. We'd made sure to gather enough green wood to make the smoke noticeable. The careers begin to arm themselves at once. An argument breaks out. It's loud enough for me to hear that it concerns whether or not the boy from District 3 should stay or accompany them.
"He's coming. We need him in the woods. And his job's done here anyway. No one can touch those supplies," says Cato.
"What about Lover Boy?" says the boy from District 1.
"I keep telling you, forget about him. I know where I cut him. It's a miracle he hasn't bled to death yet. At any rate, he's in no shape to raid us," says Cato.
So Peeta is out there in the woods, wounded badly. But I am still in the dark on what motivated him to betray the careers.
"Come on," says Cato.
He thrusts a spear into the hands of the boy from District 3, and they head off in the direction of the fire. The last thing I hear as they enter the woods is Cato saying,
"When we find her, I kill her in my own way, and no one interferes."
Somehow, I don't think he's talking about Rue. She didn't drop a nest of Tracker Jackers on him. I stay put for a half hour or so, trying to figure out what to do about the supplies. The one advantage I have with the bow and arrow is distance. I could send a flaming arrow into the pyramid easily enough. I'm a good enough shot to get it through those openings in the net, but there's no guarantee it would catch. More likely, it'd just burn itself out, and then what? I'd have achieved nothing and given them far too much information about myself. That I was here, that I have an accomplice, that I can use the bow and arrow with accuracy. There's no alternative. I'm going to have to get in closer and see if I can discover what exactly protects the supplies. In fact, I'm just about to reveal myself when a movement catches my eye. Several hundred yards to my right, I see someone emerge from the woods. For a second, I think it's Rue, but then I recognize Foxface. She's the one we couldn't remember this morning, creeping out onto the plain. When she decides it's safe, she runs for the pyramid with quick, small steps. Just before she reaches the circle of supplies that have been littered around the pyramid, she stops, searches the ground, and carefully places her feet on a spot. Then she begins to approach the pyramid with strange little hops, sometimes landing on one foot, teetering slightly, sometimes risking a few steps. At one point, she launches up in the air, over a small barrel, and lands poised on her tiptoes. But she overshot slightly, and her momentum throws her forward. I hear her give a sharp squeal as her hands hit the ground, but nothing happens. In a moment, she's regained her feet and continues until she has reached the bulk of the supplies. So, I'm right about the booby trap, but it's clearly more complex than I had imagined. I was right about the girl, too. How wily is she to have discovered this path into the food and to be able to replicate it so neatly? She fills her pack, taking a few items from a variety of containers. Crackers from a crate, a handful of apples from a burlap sack that hangs suspended from a rope off the side of a bin. But only a handful from each, not enough to tip off that the food is missing, not enough to cause suspicion. And then she's doing her odd little dance, back out of the circle and scrambling into the woods again, safe and sound. I realize I'm grinding my teeth in frustration. Foxface has confirmed what I'd already guessed. But what sort of trap have they laid that requires such dexterity? Has so many trigger points? Why did she squeal so as her hands made contact with the earth? You'd have thought, and slowly it begins to dawn on me, you'd have thought the very ground was going to explode. It's mind, I whisper. That explains everything. The courier's willingness to leave their supplies, Foxface's reaction, the involvement of the boy from District 3, where they have the factories, where they make televisions and automobiles and explosives. But where did he get them? In the supplies? That's not the sort of weapon the game makers usually provide, given that they like to see the tributes draw blood personally. I slip out of the bushes and cross to one of the round metal plates that lifted the tributes into the arena. The ground around it has been dug up and patted back down. The landmines were disabled after the 60 seconds we stood on the plates, but the boy from District 3 must have managed to reactivate them. I've never seen anyone in the games do that. I bet it came as a shock even to the game makers. Well, hooray for the boy from District 3 for putting one over on them. But what am I supposed to do now? Obviously, I can't go strolling into that mess without blowing myself sky high. As for sending in a burning arrow, that's more laughable than ever. The mines are set off by pressure. It doesn't have to be a lot, either. One year, a girl dropped her token, a small wooden ball, while she was still at her plate, and they literally had to scrape bits of her off the ground. My arm's pretty good. I might be able to chuck some rocks in there and set off what, maybe one mine? That could start a chain reaction. Or could it? Would the boy from District 3 have placed the mines in such a way that a single mine would not disturb the others, thereby protecting the supplies, but ensuring the death of the invader? Even if I only blew up one mine, I'd draw the couriers back down on me for sure. And anyway, what am I thinking? There's that net, clearly strung to deflect any such attack. Besides, what I'd really need is to throw about 30 rocks in there at once, setting off a big chain reaction, demolishing the whole lot. I glance back up at the woods. The smoke from Rue's second fire is wafting toward the sky. By now, the couriers have probably begun to suspect some sort of trick. Time is running out. There is a solution to this. I know there is. If I can only focus hard enough. I stare at the pyramid, the bins, the crates, too heavy to topple over with an arrow. Maybe one contains cooking oil. And the burning arrow idea is reviving when I realize I could end up losing all 12 of my arrows and not get a direct hit on an oil bin, since I'd just be guessing. I'm genuinely thinking of trying to recreate Foxface's trip up to the pyramid in hopes of finding a new means of destruction, when my eyes light on the burlap bag of apples. I could sever the rope in one shot. Didn't I do as much in the training center? It's a big bag, but it still might only be good for one explosion. If only I could free the apples themselves.
I know what to do. I move into range and give myself 3 arrows to get the job done.
I place my feet carefully, block out the rest of the world as I take meticulous aim.
The first arrow tears through the side of the bag near the top, leaving a split in the burlap. The second widens it to a gaping hole. I can see the first apple teetering when I let the third arrow go, catching the torn flap of burlap and ripping it from the bag. For a moment, everything seems frozen in time. Then the apples spill to the ground, and I'm blown backward into the air.
Chapter 17. The impact with the hard-packed earth of the plane knocks the wind out of me. My backpack does little to soften the blow. Fortunately, my quiver has caught in the crook of my elbow, sparing both itself and my shoulder, and my bow is locked in my grasp. The ground still shakes with explosions. I can't hear them. I can't hear anything at the moment, but the apples must have set off enough mines, causing debris to activate the others. I manage to shield my face with my arms as shattered bits of matter, some of it burning, rain down around me. An acrid smoke fills the air, which is not the best remedy for someone trying to regain the ability to breathe. After about a minute, the ground stops vibrating. I roll on my side and allow myself a moment of satisfaction at the sight of the smoldering wreckage that was recently the pyramid. The careers aren't likely to salvage anything out of that.
I'd better get out of here, I think. They'll be making a beeline for the place. But once I'm on my feet, I realize escape may not be so simple. I'm dizzy. Not the slightly wobbly kind, but the kind that sends the trees swooping around you and causes the earth to move in waves under your feet. I take a few steps and somehow wind up on my hands and knees. I wait a few minutes to let it pass, but it doesn't. Panic begins to set in. I can't stay here. Flight is essential, but I can neither walk nor hear. I place a hand on my left ear, the one that was turned toward the blast, and it comes away bloody. Have I gone deaf from the explosion? The idea frightens me. I rely as much on my ears as my eyes as a hunter, maybe more at times, but I can't let my fear show. Absolutely, positively, I am live on every scream in Panem. No blood trails, I tell myself, and manage to pull my hood up over my head, tie the cord under my chin with uncooperative fingers. That should help soak up the blood. I can't walk, but can I crawl? I move forward tentatively. Yes, if I go very slowly, I can crawl. Most of the woods will offer insufficient cover. My only hope is to make it back to Rue's copse and conceal myself in greenery. I can't get caught out here on my hands and knees in the open. Not only will I face death, it's sure to be a long and painful one at Cato's hand. The thought of Prim having to watch that keeps me doggedly inching my way toward the hideout. Another blast knocks me flat on my face. A stray mine, set off by some collapsing crate. This happens twice more. I'm reminded of those last few kernels that burst when Prim and I pop corn over the fire at home. To say I make it in the nick of time is an understatement. I have literally just dragged myself into the tangle of bushes at the base of the trees when there's Cato, barreling onto the plain, soon followed by his companions. His rage is so extreme it might be comical. So people really do tear out their hair and beat the ground with their fists. If I didn't know that it was aimed at me, at what I have done to him. Add to that my proximity, my inability to run or defend myself, and in fact, the whole thing has me terrified. I'm glad my hiding place makes it impossible for the cameras to get a close shot of me, because I'm biting my nails like there's no tomorrow, gnawing off the last bits of nail polish, trying to keep my teeth from chattering. The boy from District 3 throws stones into the ruins and must have declared all the mines activated because the careers are approaching the wreckage. Cato has finished the first phase of his tantrum and takes out his anger on the smoking remains by kicking open various containers.
The other tributes are poking around in the mess, looking for anything to salvage, but there's nothing. The boy from District 3 has done his job too well. This idea must occur to Kato, too, because he turns on the boy and appears to be shouting at him. The boy from District 3 only has time to turn and run before Kato catches him in a headlock from behind. I can see the muscles ripple in Kato's arms as he sharply jerks the boy's head to the side. It's that quick, the death of the boy from District 3. The other two careers seem to be trying to calm Kato down. I can tell he wants to return to the woods, but they keep pointing at the sky, which puzzles me until I realize, of course, they think whoever set off the explosions is dead. They don't know about the arrows and the apples. They assume the booby trap was faulty, but that the tribute who blew up the supplies was killed doing it. If there was a cannon shot, it would have been easily lost in the subsequent explosions. The shattered remains of the thief removed by hovercraft. They retire to the far side of the lake to allow the game makers to retrieve the body of the boy from District 3. And they wait. I suppose a cannon goes off. A hovercraft appears and takes the dead boy. The sun dips below the horizon. Night falls. Up in the sky, I see the seal and know the anthem must have begun. A moment of darkness. They show the boy from District 3. They show the boy from District 10, who must have died this morning. Then the seal reappears. So, now they know. The bomber survived. In the seal's light, I can see Kato and the girl from District 2 put on their night vision glasses. The boy from District 1 ignites a tree branch for a torch, illuminating the grim determination on all their faces. The careers stride back into the woods to hunt. The dizziness has subsided, and while my left ear is still deafened, I can hear a ringing in my right, which seems a good sign. There's no point in leaving my hiding place, though. I'm about as safe as I can be, here at the crime scene. They probably think the bomber has a 2 or 3 hour lead on them. Still, it's a long time before I risk moving. The first thing I do is dig out my own glasses and put them on, which relaxes me a little, to have at least one of my hunter's senses working. I drink some water and wash the blood from my ear. Fearing the smell of meat will draw unwanted predators, fresh blood is bad enough. I make a good meal out of the greens and roots and berries Rue and I gathered today. Where is my little ally? Did she make it back to the rendezvous point? Is she worried about me? At least, the sky has shown we're both alive. I run through the surviving tributes on my fingers. The boy from 1, both from 2, Fox Face, both from 11 and 12. Just 8 of us. The betting must be getting really hot in the capital. They'll be doing special features on each of us now, probably interviewing our friends and families. It's been a long time since a tribute from District 12 made it into the top 8. And now there are 2 of us. Although from what Kato said, Peter's on his way out. Not that Kato is the final word on anything. Didn't he just lose his entire stash of supplies? Let the 74th Hunger Games begin, Kato, I think. Let them begin for real. A cold breeze has sprung up. I reach for my sleeping bag before I remember I left it with Rue. I was supposed to pick up another one, but what with all the mines and all, I forgot. I begin to shiver. Since roosting overnight in a tree isn't sensible anyway, I scoop out a hollow under the bushes and cover myself with leaves and pine needles. I'm still freezing. I lay my sheet of plastic over my upper body and position my backpack to block the wind. It's a little better. I begin to have more sympathy for the girl from District 8 that lit the fire that first night. But now it's me who needs to grit my teeth and tough it out until morning. More leaves, more pine needles. I pull my arms inside my jacket and tuck my knees up to my chest. Somehow, I drift off to sleep. When I open my eyes, the world looks slightly fractured, and it takes me a minute to realize that the sun must be well up and the glasses fragmenting my vision. As I sit up and remove them, I hear a laugh somewhere near the lake and freeze. The laugh's distorted, but the fact that it registered at all means I must be regaining my hearing. Yes, my right ear can hear again, although it's still ringing. As for my left ear, well, at least the bleeding has stopped. I peer through the bushes, afraid the couriers have returned, trapping me here for an indefinite time. No, it's Foxface, standing in the rubble of the pyramid and laughing. She's smarter than the couriers, actually finding a few useful items in the ashes, a metal pot, a knife blade. I'm perplexed by her amusement until I realize that with the career's stores eliminated, she might actually stand a chance, just like the rest of us. It crosses my mind to reveal myself and enlist her as a second ally against that pack, but I rule it out. There's something about that sly grin that makes me sure that befriending Foxface would ultimately get me a knife in the back. With that in mind, this might be an excellent time to shoot her. But she's heard something, not me, because her head turns away, toward the drop-off, and she sprints for the woods. I wait. No one. Nothing shows up. Still, if Foxface thought it was dangerous, maybe it's time for me to get out of here, too. Besides, I'm eager to tell Rue about the pyramid. Since I've no idea where the couriers are, the route back by the stream seems as good as any. I hurry, loaded bow in one hand, a hunk of cold grusling in the other. Because I'm famished now, and not just for leaves and berries, but for the fat and protein in the meat. The trip to the stream is uneventful. Once there, I refill my water and wash, taking particular care with my injured ear. Then I travel uphill, using the stream as a guide. At one point, I find boot prints in the mud along the bank. The couriers have been here, but not for a while. The prints are deep, because they were made in soft mud, but now they're nearly dry in the hot sun. I haven't been careful enough about my own tracks, counting on a light tread and the pine needles to conceal my prints. Now I strip off my boots and socks and go barefoot up the bed of the stream. The cool water has an invigorating effect on my body, my spirits. I shoot two fish, easy pickings in this slow-moving stream, and go ahead and eat one raw even though I've just had the grusling. The second I'll save for Rue. Gradually, subtly, the ringing in my right ear diminishes until it's gone entirely. I find myself pawing at my left ear periodically, trying to clean away whatever deadens its ability to collect sounds. If there's improvement, it's undetectable. I can't adjust to deafness in the ear. It makes me feel off balance and defenseless to my left. Blind, even. My head keeps turning to the injured side. As my right ear tries to compensate for the wall of nothingness where yesterday there was a constant flow of information. The more time that passes, the less hopeful I am that this is an injury that will heal. When I reach the site of our first meeting, I feel certain it's been undisturbed. There's no sign of Rue, not on the ground or in the trees. This is odd. By now she should have returned, as it's midday. Undoubtedly, she spent the night in a tree somewhere. What else could she do with no light and the couriers with their night vision glasses tromping around the woods? And the third fire she was supposed to set, although I forgot to check for it last night, was the farthest from our sight of all. She's probably just being cautious about making her way back. I wish she'd hurry, because I don't want to hang around here too long. I want to spend the afternoon traveling to higher ground, hunting as we go. But there's nothing really for me to do but wait. I wash the blood out of my jacket and hair, and clean my ever-growing list of wounds. The burns are much better, but I use a bit of medicine on them anyway. The main thing to worry about now is keeping out infection. I go ahead and eat the second fish. It isn't going to last long in this hot sun, but it should be easy enough to spear a few more for Rue. If she would just show up. Feeling too vulnerable on the ground with my lopsided hearing, I scale a tree to wait. If the couriers show up, this will be a fine place to shoot them from. The sun moves slowly. I do things to pass the time, chew leaves, and apply them to my stings that are deflated but still tender. Comb through my damp hair with my fingers and braid it, lace my boots back up, check over my bow and remaining 9 arrows, test my left ear repeatedly for signs of life by rustling a leaf near it, but without good results. Despite the gruesling and the fish, my stomach's growling, and I know I'm going to have what we call a hollow day back in District 12. That's a day where no matter what you put in your belly, it's never enough. Having nothing to do but sit in a tree makes it worse, so I decide to give in to it. After all, I've lost a lot of weight in the arena. I need some extra calories. And having the bow and arrows makes me far more confident about my future prospects. I slowly peel and eat a handful of nuts. My last cracker, the gruesling neck. That's good because it takes time to pick clean. Finally, a gruesling wing and the bird is history. But it's a hollow day, and even with all that, I start daydreaming about food, particularly the decadent dishes served in the capital, the chicken and creamy orange sauce, the cakes and pudding, bread with butter, noodles and green sauce, the lamb and dried plum stew. I suck on a few mint leaves and tell myself to get over it. Mint is good because we drink mint tea after supper often, so it tricks my stomach into thinking eating time is over. Sort of. Dangling up in the tree, with the sun warming me, a mouthful of mint, my bow and arrows at hand. This is the most relaxed I've been since I've entered the arena. If only Rue would show up and we could clear out. As the shadows grow, so does my restlessness. By late afternoon, I've resolved to go looking for her. I can at least visit the spot where she set the third fire and see if there are any clues to her whereabouts. Before I go, I scatter a few mint leaves around our old campfire. Since we gathered these some distance away, Rue will understand I've been here, while they'll mean nothing to the couriers. In less than an hour, I'm at the place where we agreed to have the third fire, and I know something has gone amiss. The wood has been neatly arranged, expertly interspersed with tinder, but it has never been lit. Rue set up the fire, but never made it back here. Somewhere between the second column of smoke I spied before I blew up the supplies, and this point, she ran into trouble. I have to remind myself she's still alive, or is she? Could the cannon shot announcing her death have come in the wee hours of the morning, when even my good ear was too broken to pick it up? Will she appear in the sky tonight? No, I refuse to believe it. There could be 100 other explanations. She could have lost her way, run into a pack of predators or another tribute like Thresh, and had to hide. Whatever happened, I'm almost certain she's stuck out there, somewhere between the second fire and the unlit one at my feet. Something is keeping her up a tree. I think I'll go hunt it down. It's a relief to be doing something after sitting around all afternoon. I creep silently through the shadows, letting them conceal me, but nothing seems suspicious. There's no sign of any kind of struggle, no disruption of the needles on the ground. I've stopped for just a moment when I hear it. I have to cock my head around to the side to be sure, but there it is again. Rue's 4-note tune coming out of a mockingjay's mouth, the one that means she's all right. I grin and move in the direction of the bird. Another, just a short distance ahead, picks up on a handful of notes. Rue has been singing to them, and recently, otherwise they'd have taken up some other song. My eyes lift up into the trees, searching for a sign of her. I swallow and sing softly back, hoping she'll know it's safe to join me. A mockingjay repeats the melody to me, and that's when I hear the scream. It's a child's scream, a young girl's scream. There's no one in the arena capable of making that sound except Rue. And now I'm running, knowing this may be a trap, knowing the three careers may be poised to attack me, but I can't help myself. There's another high-pitched cry, this time my name.
Katniss! Katniss!
Roo! I shout back, so she knows I'm near, so they know I'm near. And hopefully the girl, who has attacked them with tracker jackers and gotten an 11 they still can't explain, will be enough to pull their attention away from her. Roo! I'm coming! When I break into the clearing, she's on the ground, hopelessly entangled in a net. She just has time to reach her hand through the mesh and say my name before the spear enters her body.
Chapter 18. The boy from District 1 dies before he can pull out the spear. My arrow drives deeply into the center of his neck. He falls to his knees and halves the brief remainder of his life by yanking out the arrow and drowning in his own blood. I'm reloaded, shifting my aim from side to side, while I shout at Rue, "Are there more? Are there more?" She has to say no several times before I hear it. Rue has rolled to her side, her body curved in and around the spear. I shove the boy away from her and pull out my knife, freeing her from the net. One look at the wound, and I know it's far beyond my capacity to heal. Beyond anyone's, probably. The spearhead is buried up to the shaft in her stomach. I crouch before her, staring helplessly at the embedded weapon. There's no point in comforting words, in telling her she'll be all right. She's no fool. Her hand reaches out, and I clutch it like a lifeline, as if it's me who's dying instead of Rue.
"You blew up the food?" she whispers.
"Every last bit," I say.
"You have to win," she says.
"I'm going to. Going to win for both of us now. I promise." I hear a cannon and look up. It must be for the boy from District 1.
"Don't go."
Rue tightens her grip on my hand.
"Course not.
Staying right here," I say. I move in closer to her, pulling her head onto my lap. I gently brush the dark, thick hair back behind her ear.
"Sing,"
she says, but I barely catch the word. "Sing," I think. "Sing what?" I do know a few songs. Believe it or not, there was once music in my house, too. Music I helped make. My father pulled me in with that remarkable voice. But I haven't sung much since he died. Except when Prim is very sick. Then I sing her the same songs she liked as a baby. Sing. My throat is tight with tears, hoarse from smoke and fatigue. But if this is Prim's, I mean Rue's, last request, I have to at least try. The song that comes to me is a simple lullaby, one we sing fretful, hungry babies to sleep with. It's old. Very old, I think. Made up long ago in the hills. What my music teacher calls a mountain air. But the words are easy and soothing, promising tomorrow will be more hopeful than this awful piece of time we call today. I give a small cough, swallow hard, and begin.
Deep in the meadow, under the willow, a bed of grass. A soft green pillow, lay down your head and close your sleepy eyes, and when again they open the sun will rise. Here it's safe, here it's warm, here the daisies guard you from every harm. Here your dreams are sweet and tomorrow brings them true. Here is the place where I love you.
Rue's eyes have fluttered shut. Her chest moves, but only slightly. My throat releases the tears, and they slide down my cheeks. But I have to finish the song for her.
Deep in the meadow, hidden far away, a cloak of leaves, a moonbeam ray. Forget your woes, and let your troubles lay, and when again it's morning, they'll wash away. Here it's safe, here it's warm, here the daisies guard you from air.